This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 159, The Lovers of Wisdom. Once again, I just want to remind everyone that I am one of the keynote speakers at this year's Intelligent Speech Online Conference. I will be presenting on the companionship and rivals of the Persian monarchy and their nobility in one of the keynote slots this year. And we have a great lineup of other speakers doing roundtables and Q&As and presenting on a wide variety of historical topics. You can get your tickets for that for the early bird rate of $20 until the end of the year, and you can bring that down by an additional 10% using my promo code Persia. Get those tickets at intelligentspeechonline.com or follow the link in the episode description. And I very much hope to see you on February 28th, 2026. Last time, we had a bit of a doubleheader episode. I covered the extended royal family of Seleucus II Callinicus, including how he put down one last revolt in Antioch involving his now executed aunt, Stratonike of Macedon. Then Callinicus fell off his horse and died, and we moved on to the short and troubled reign of his eldest son, who took the regnal name Seleucus III Carinaus. Carinaus tried to carry out his father's plans for war against Attalus of Pergamon in an effort to retake Anatolia after many disastrous revolts and civil wars across the empire. Instead, Attalus quickly dispatched two Seleucid army groups, and a few of the commanders in Seleucus III's own column poisoned the king after just 3 years on the throne. We left off with Carinaus's younger brother, Antiochus, preparing to become king himself. But starting today, the narrative is on an extended pause. I'll be honest, the next phase of Seleucid history is a bit of a hydra. Every time I try to tackle a topic, I discover two more stories that we will need to address. I'm writing almost 10 full episodes out at this point, and I'm still going back and revising the next narrative episode with each new script because so many things are happening all at once. Plus, while the Seleucids have been busy with a civil war, the Western powers in the Hellenistic world have been very busy themselves. I have to deal with that too, which means there is a Meet the Neighbors episode coming up. However, we've technically killed three kings without their requisite buffer episodes recently, if you include the baby Antiochus, son of Berenike. So, I'm buying myself some breathing room by trying to tackle two infinitely more complex topics that I don't personally enjoy researching. Traditionally, and I think this far into the show we can call it a tradition, I've done an episode about religion after each king's death. And during my last Q&A episode, several people asked, what about philosophy? So somewhat against my better judgment, I'm going to do my best here. I'll be honest, I find pure philosophy to be exceptionally dull, but apparently I'm the weird one. Here's the catch. I've covered lots of topics I'm not personally invested in. The Seleucids, for example. They're important, but the arrival of Arsaces in our story has been a genuine breath of fresh air to me. The reason I've barely touched philosophy up to this point is that it doesn't really have a natural place in the history of Persia. The Greek literary genre that evolved into the field of philosophy is just that. Greek. The Persians and their predecessors in West Asia did not have an equivalent concept, even now that the Greco-Macedonian Seleucids are running the show. I'm in an unusual position. Our sources for the Seleucids, especially up to the current point in our narrative, just barely exist. There's quite a lot of information that comes from single sentences or paragraphs in non-historical writing, which just happens to reference something from Seleucid history. We do not have an intellectual history of the empire or the philosophical developments inside Seleucid territory in the same way that we have documentation from classical Greece, the Antigonid Kingdom, Ptolemaic Egypt, or eventually Rome. In the next episode, I am going to do as much as I can to explain what Seleucid philosophy was like. But to get there, we need to go back and understand what philosophy was by the late 3rd century BCE and how it got to that point. This is not going to be exhaustive. If you want something like that, The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps is a great podcast. Derek from the Hellenistic Age did a great series of episodes on Hellenistic philosophy in particular a few years ago. Some of today's topics will come back in future philosophy episodes too, but for now, it's the abridged version. The word philosophy in modern English is a pretty direct adaptation of the Greek word philosophia, a compound of the words philos, meaning love, and sophia, meaning wisdom. Philosophy, the love of wisdom, philosopher, or Greek philosophos, one who loves wisdom, etc. It is defined as the study of the nature and meaning of the universe and of human life, or a particular set or system of beliefs resulting from the search for knowledge about life and the universe. And of course, a bunch of other more colloquial definitions exist, like basically every other word in the English language. But I want to start with the study of nature, because that is actually very important context to understanding what philosophy meant in antiquity. The first word used to describe philosophers was not actually lovers of wisdom, but physikoi, sometimes translated as physicists, because they are related words. But the more accurate English term would probably be naturalist. Physikoi, from the Greek physis, simply meaning nature. They were people who studied the natural world, and by the start of the Hellenistic Age, the philosopher Aristotle was keen to draw a distinction between physikoi, like himself, and the Theologoi, who studied the wants and needs of the gods. That is one of the key distinctions between the evolution of Greek philosophy and similar pursuits in other cultures. The divorce, or at least attempted separation, between studying nature and studying religion. In antiquity, for most people, there was not a distinction between those who looked for a natural order in metaphysical concepts like ethics and morality, and what we would call physical sciences today, studying how the literal physical world functioned. And this, for the record, is why nobody likes moral philosophers. Much of what they studied could reasonably fall under the categories of mathematics, astronomy, engineering, biology, or physics today. Those aren't the aspects I'm going to focus on here, especially because they became more separated over time. Today, I want to focus on philosophy in the modern sense. Traditionally, early philosophy is divided into pre-Socratic and Socratic beliefs, using the semi-historical teachings of the Athenian Socrates as a dividing line. And while Socratic-style philosophy did come to dominate later Greek thought, as we've seen in the Orphic Mysteries episode, that was not exclusive. Pre-Socratic influences, like Pythagoras, continued to play their role, but generally speaking, that division works well enough. Somewhat ironically, despite my personal neglect, the rise of Greek philosophy has actually been deeply tied to our narrative this entire time. The first pre-Socratic philosophers, as we understand them, were based in Ionia, especially our favorite Ionian city in Miletus, during the mid-6th century BC, right at the same time that Cyrus the Great conquered that region. The first of these Milesian philosophers, as far as we know, was Thales. And like many of the early philosophers, ancient tradition held that he was extremely well-traveled, having visited Babylon and Egypt to consult with the sages and priests of their temples. That said, it's just as likely that Babylonians and Egyptians came to Miletus, bringing their ideas with them. Thales represents a good starting point for how naturalist studies slowly evolved into the metaphysics we associate with philosophy today. As Thales was much more of a proto-scientist than some of his successors, he, like many early philosophers, was interested in understanding the universe as composed entirely of a single material substance called the Archae, from which everything else derived. In Thales' mind, this was water. After all, the world is covered in the stuff. It falls from the sky, plants and animals are full of fluids, rivers and springs bubble up from the earth. We even saw a version of this idea continuing to circulate in Orphic beliefs. One of Thales' contemporaries, Anaximander, was no less a polymath, but got more abstract with his own concept of the first principle, theorizing that the cosmos formed from an undefinable substance that was purely neutral, and deviation from that neutrality gave rise to opposite concepts like hot and cold, wet and dry, and so on. Another, Heraclitus, thought of the first principle as fire, an ever-changing and shifting manifestation of energy that can be manipulated to change the world around it, and through this single source, opposite concepts could be reconciled. If you add fire, cold becomes hot. If you take it away, hot becomes cold. More importantly, Heraclitus also introduced the concept of the logos, literally a word for a word, but in this use meaning a sort of universal law that dictated how the universe works. Heraclitus' logos, perhaps more than any other pre-Socratic concept, had dramatic implications for later philosophical and theological thought. Heraclitus is also usually where we start seeing modern scholars speculate about Iranian influence on Greek philosophy, largely based on this idea of fire as a fundamental component to the universe. I suppose that is possible. Fire does hold a very important place in Zoroastrian belief, but it does not hold the position that a lot of early modern people assumed. Fire is not the prime deity. They are not literally exclusively worshipping fire as the god. It is a representation and manifestation of Ahura Mazda on Earth, or in some cases, the middleman figure of the Yezada Adar, but it is not itself the god, which seems to be the misunderstood belief that people sometimes suggest led Heraclitus to interpret fire as a first principle. Personally, I think it is just as likely that it was a happy coincidence when Iranians first started playing a role in Milesian society that Heraclitus was also working on this idea. There were also the Eleatics, a school from southern Greece in the town of Elias, who frankly were just weird. They believed that everything came from one unchanging source, and that the concept of motion was an illusion because motion would imply change. This then led the Greco-Thracian philosophers Leucippos and Democritus to come up with the theory of atoms, suggesting that the first principle was actually imperceptibly small, explaining why the cause of some physical phenomenon could not be visually observed. Ironically, the word atom was taken from this philosophy to describe the actual invisible particles that do sort of act as a first principle of the universe. But this is not a sign that Leucippos knew about modern physics. He just came up with the word that physicists borrowed later. At the root of all of this was logic, a word we derive from the theories that sprung from Heraclitus's logos and reasoning. Logically, everything came from somewhere, and the early Greeks were doing their best to understand what that was through logical sequences of cause and effect. But even the atomists got weird with it, with Democritus determining that human senses were actually not responding to real phenomenon, and that anything we perceive that isn't part of the atom, e.g. color, flavor, or temperature, was just invented convention to describe one experience relative to other experiences. There were other schools, such as the Sophists, who were quite popular in their time but derided by even more popular figures, and ultimately, of the pre-Socratics, it was the early Physikoi who had the most influence on the thought processes of their successors. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Socrates was the person who most famously transitioned philosophy from almost exclusively trying to understand the natural world through observation, mathematics, and logic, to applying those same principles to more and more metaphysical concepts like morality. Unfortunately, much like the pre-Socratics, we exclusively know of Socrates' own thoughts through later works. And more unfortunately, those are mostly the later works of Socrates' own student Plato, written in argument against some of Socrates' other students. So we are getting a very biased image from Plato of what Socrates was like. Socrates and his followers followed a belief system that saw wisdom, meaning total accrued knowledge, as the goal of life. Knowledge was truth, aka irrefutable fact, and they believed this could be achieved through rigorous self-examination and questioning in open dialogue, often in a public forum, though that wasn't strictly required. The so-called Socratic method was a way of interrogating and critiquing a self-proclaimed expert on a topic and breaking down the subject by asking nominally logical questions in response to each expert's statement. Inevitably, this led to some contradiction, which was seen as a flaw in the expert's knowledge. Some of Socrates' favorite topics to interrogate were ideas of justice, piety, and morality. Somewhat ironically here, at least according to Plato, the only wisdom Socrates ever claimed to have truly achieved was the ability to recognize his own ignorance, meaning his lack of ultimate knowledge on most of the topics which fascinated him. The Socratic tendency to argue with recognized experts and public figures, then pull them into embarrassing contradictions that called their expertise into question, ultimately came back around with consequences. In 399 BCE, Socrates was found guilty of undermining civic religion and corrupting the Athenian youth, and thus sentenced to death by drinking poison. This probably had more than a little to do with the fact that a lot of his followers were closely associated with the 30 tyrants backed by Sparta after the Peloponnesian War, and how the constant questioning of authority undermined the democratic government of a city that had only recently evicted a foreign occupation. Also, and I feel this so strongly that having to research Socrates almost made me stop writing this episode entirely, the Socratic method is a terrible way to engage in informational discourse. Getting an expert to make a mistake or contradict themselves does not make them less of an expert. and may point out a flaw in a particularly pompous authority figure, but mostly it proves that information about esoteric or complicated subject matter is itself complex. It's the most rudimentary debate club tactic better suited to harassing politically active freshmen than acquiring anything that could be realistically described as wisdom. In short, I'm glad he's dead. And with Socrates dead, we move on to the so-called Socratic philosophies. Ultimately, Socrates personally is only known secondhand, and the specifics of his philosophy are obscured to us, since what we do know is primarily in the writing of his student, Plato, an Athenian aristocrat who wrote not in explanatory treatises, but in hypothetical dialogues, using imagined conversations between characters to express his ideas. Socrates was not his only teacher. Most notably, Plato spent lots of time in Syracuse and studied with the Pythagoreans for a time, gradually developing the basis for the philosophical school that came to be known as Platonism. Much like the monist ideas of some pre-Socratic philosophers, Platonism is centered on the theory of forms. Essentially, this argues that the physical world is not as true as the idealized forms, timeless, absolute, non-physical, and unchanging ideal versions of all things. Objects and matter in the real world merely imitate or resemble these ideal forms. Abstract ideas of perfect versions and feelings that the human mind struggles to comprehend. In Plato's Republic, he identifies good as the highest form, equating it with earlier monist ideas of the Arche, that first principle of the universe. The ideal form of goodness, in Platonic belief, is the source of all other forms. This could only be reached through internal dialectic, holding dialogue within your own soul to arrive at the true form of good by practicing logical reasoning, free of subjective biases about what is and is not good. In this way, Platonism, unlike its Socratic roots, was one of the first Greek philosophies to arrive at a sort of moral absolutism. Plato and his followers believed there was an objectively true ideal of goodness in the universe that could be understood logically. Thus, in the Platonist view, virtue is knowledge, in the Socratic sense of objective understanding, of the form of good. You are virtuous if you use reasoning to understand that ideal form of goodness. Plato's philosophical school was much more formal than Socrates' ad hoc haranguing of public figures, which was probably a good thing because that ended very poorly for Socrates. Over time in Athens, Plato developed a school in the Academia, an Athenian precinct containing an olive grove dedicated to the city's patron goddess, Athena. Of course, by hosting Plato's famous school, the Academia became synonymous with education, giving us English words like academy, academic, and academia. Plato, though partially influenced by the Pythagoreans, had nothing on his successors presiding over the academy in the 4th and early 3rd centuries BCE. There was immense interest by that time in fusing more theological teachings and mathematics from the Pythagoreans with Plato's forms. From that academy came the Peripatetic school, a favorite of the non-citizen philosophers in Athens who couldn't own property and establish a private gathering place for themselves. They gathered instead in the Lyceum, an open forum inside the city. Initially, this was an informal gathering of like-minded teachers, but eventually one of them, Theophrastus, organized the Peripatetics a bit more. However, their movement was pioneered by a young philosopher who had recently left Plato's Academy to travel. But before long, this founding figure left again, and went off to Macedon, where he had been hired by King Philip II as a private tutor. Of course, this was Aristotle. Honestly, I debated even including Aristotle in this episode. His influence on the history of philosophy is kind of hard to quantify. On one hand, he is undoubtedly one of the most important philosophical voices ever recorded. On the other hand, his teachings were sort of absorbed by other schools until the Middle Ages, when Aristotle became an important font of information to early Islamic philosophy. Aristotle wrote extensively on such a wide array of topics that it's hard to fully explain him without diverting into another show entirely. For that, go listen to The History of Philosophy without any gaps. Peter Adamson is much better at this than I am anyway. However, while Plato and the Peripatetic school were mostly falling by the wayside during the Hellenistic period, another subset of philosophers came to dominate Hellenistic or Middle Platonism, the Skeptics. Skepticism is still a major field of modern philosophy, but the ancient skeptics were a bit different. While modern skepticism is usually very specific in what claims the skeptic in question doubts, the ancient skeptics were, by and large, a reaction to the epistemological dogma of other philosophical schools, like early Platonism and many pre-Socratics that claimed they could logic their way into absolute truth. This began as a distinct field of study with Pyrrho of Elis, whose personal teachings developed into what else but a philosophy called Pyrrhonism. The Pyrrhonists wanted to achieve ataraxia, a state of untroubled contentment for the soul and inner peace. They thought they would achieve this by suspending their judgment, essentially setting themselves at rest by refusing to affirm or deny any claims that were not self-evident. Basically, there are observable facts about the world, but claims like Plato's good being the ultimate form of all things, or even that Platonic forms exist in the first place, could not be proven, and therefore should not be judged by the Pyrrhonists. It was basically a philosophical belief built on the principle of pix or it didn't happen. This eventually intersected with Plato's Academy, though more than a century after its founder had died. In 266 BCE, a skeptic philosopher called Arcesilaus became the head of the academy, giving rise to the philosophy called academic skepticism. Academic here in the sense that it was taught in the Athenian Academia. At its base, academic skepticism followed a very similar thought process to Pyrrhonism, doubting all but the most obvious and observable facts. However, the Academy still leaned on Plato and Socrates. They accepted Plato's assertion that there were absolute truths in the universe, but embraced Socrates' view of his own ignorance and used skeptical logic to assert that humanity could not hope to truly understand the truth as Plato described it. The academics weren't seeking ataraxia, inner peace. Instead, they railed against the dogmatic approach of other philosophical schools. They acknowledged that some version of Platonic good existed within them as a sort of moral law, a potential guide for their morality, but they believed that fully understanding that morality was impossible. Their big departure from Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, and many other earlier philosophers was the conclusion that just as the physical senses can be deceived, human logic and reasoning will also be flawed and cannot be used to determine absolute truths about the universe. All right, even writing this, I'm running out of steam, so we're going to skip the Cyrenaic philosophers and Megarian dialectics, because quite frankly, there is a reason that everyone forgets about those two. If you like dialectics, by all means, skip ahead in the timeline to Hegel, but for the love of God, actually read Hegel instead of just replaying Fallout New Vegas. Instead, we are going to jump over to Epicureanism, which got its start in late 4th century Athens with a guy named Epicurus. What else? Epicurus, just by nature of being in Athens at that time, was in a Socratic milieu. But the base of his own philosophical school was decidedly pre-Socratic, returning to the idea of atomism. That is the kind of loony idea that the universe is made up of tiny particles and truly empty space. Everything we perceive is made up of these invisible particles working together to form larger bodies, and in Epicurus's view, there were an infinite number of atoms of different types, and thus the possibility for an infinite number of worlds made up of atoms, just separated by great expanses of cosmic void. He even suggested that some of those worlds could be radically different from our own. Like an entire world made up of, I don't know, let's say, gases. A truly ludicrous theory rejected by many of the other great minds of his day. To solve the problem of cause and effect that many of the more logical schools, like the skeptics, spent all of their time thinking about, Epicurus introduced the swerve, random movement of the atoms that explained why the entire universe wasn't just a series of atoms bumping into one another in an endless train of equal and opposite reaction. Yes, people thought of that before Newton. Isaac just did the math. On a more traditionally philosophical level, Epicurus suggested that this swerve in the atoms was also what allowed free will in thinking beings, which was a concept that many of the other Socratic philosophies had struggled with in their view of moral absolutism. Epicurean physics is actually a very interesting way for pre-modern people to have accidentally gotten very close to our modern understanding of the universe, using the tools and concepts available in their time. But I want to shift our focus to Epicurean moral philosophy now, because, oh boy, do I have a loaded term for you. I said we were skipping the Cyrenaics, which we mostly are, but Epicurus was influenced by one idea popularized by the Libyan Greeks. Hedonism. Quite literally, this means the belief system of pleasure, and it is often used to describe a sort of irreverent, amoral pleasure-seeking when used colloquially. Quite frankly, that is not too far off from the Cyrenaics, who emphasized immediate gratification as a moral good, but Epicurus put a little bit more thought into that than colloquial use suggests. Specifically, the Epicureans saw the pursuit of pleasure as the chief good in life, but emphasized living in such a way that you maximized the amount of pleasure available to you over the entire course of your life. That means thinking ahead, planning, and anything but immediate gratification. Sure, drinking all of the wine at tonight's party will bring you pleasure now, but how will that behavior affect your total lifetime pleasure between hangovers and damage to your health? Or, in another view, marriage and passionate love were to be avoided and recreational sex was natural but best avoided. Why? Because A, that would imply you're doing things for the pleasure and support of others, and B, love leads to drama down the line which can cause displeasure. Pleasure was the opposite of pain, and thus anything that could lead to mental, emotional, or physical pain was to be avoided. In the Epicurean view, pleasures were natural and necessary, such as food and shelter, natural but unnecessary to continued living, like sex, good food, and comfortable conditions, or vain and empty, things which brought pleasure but could not be permanently fulfilled or maximized, like the pursuit of wealth. The vain and empty pleasures were to be avoided because they too would eventually cause pain of one type or another. In terms of politics and interpersonal relations, the Epicureans promoted the idea that justice was an abstract concept defined solely by mutual benefit for all parties involved. And through that, Epicurus arrived at an early version of the modern political theory of a social contract. Society's laws and their enforcement existed to protect one person from being harmed by another, thus maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain as much as possible. In his view, laws that did not contribute to human happiness were simply unjust. Religiously, the Epicureans took an almost deist approach to the Greek gods. They did not outright deny their existence, but they did not believe that the gods interfered with humanity or the universe in an active sense. To them, the gods made sure that their spheres of influence existed and took very little interest in worldly affairs after that point. Instead, living in a space between worlds somewhere out in the void between atoms. Some more atheistic Epicureans even suggested that the gods were just human ideals given names and identities. Those Epicureans must not have been reading the same Iliad as me, just saying. And you know what? I actually kind of like the Epicureans, so I'll make a deal with you, my audience. I will shelve the other two big Hellenistic philosophies, Cynicism and Stoicism, because I can't really stand either of them, and I want to end this episode on a high note. I will come back to them before shipping off the Greeks to be Derek's exclusive problem again, but for now, I'm calling it a day. Next time, I will try to explain as much as I can about why there's not much to say on Seleucid philosophy and the little bit of work that has been done to change that. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.